BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is a download of Farming Today This Week from the BBC. The presenter today, Charlotte Smith.
I'm in a field in the West Midlands, watching a man dig a hole. The reason is that this week we are talking all about soil, and I'm with farmer Tim Parton. The reason I'm laughing is that he's dug his hole, and the first thing he's done is got a clod of earth and started smelling it. Tim, what are you doing?
I'm just evaluating my soil health. The first thing I always do is smell the soil. I can assess my soil health without any electronic devices. I just know that this is a healthy soil.
I've got my nose right in it, and it just smells like earth.
It's health. It's alive. You can feel it's alive.
How long have you been on this farm then, Tim?
Well, I've been here all my life. My father was a farm manager here before me, so I've sort of grown up here.
And how big is it? What do you do here?
We're a 300-hectare farm, basically arable cropping. I have a varied rotation as long as possible, and I'm growing for profitability, obviously, but I'm also growing for what the field needs, what's going to improve that soil and take it forward.
We're going to talk more about farming and the soil later in the programme, but the reason we're talking about soil is because it's valuable. We obviously need it to grow food. It also stores carbon from the atmosphere, soaks up water, and can help prevent flooding. It also filters and purifies the water. Over the last few years, though, soil health has become a major talking point because soil is in trouble. Now, the reason for that are many and varied, but intensive farming practices have been blamed. We've also got problems with compaction and erosion. The Committee on Climate Change found that the UK has lost 84% of its fertile topsoil since 1850. A study from Cranfield University found the annual cost of soil degradation across England and Wales is over £1 billion. Let's talk to Mike Harrington. He's the agronomist here on the farm. Mike, what is soil degradation?
The difficulty, I suppose, really over the last 50, 60 years is we've had a chemical way of farming. We've created a lot of growth, created yields, but it's been at the expense of biology of soil. And as soils degrade, as we use lots of nitrogen, we cultivate soils, we take straw off, as time goes on, organic matter's dropped to a point where life in the soil can't work, can't function. We get soils which become more dense, poorer root systems, and the whole thing starts to degrade and get worse and worse and worse.
A lot of farmers would say, though, that it's perfectly possible to farm chemically, as you describe it, and also have healthy soils, that it's not a binary choice.
You're absolutely right, and that's the difficulty, really. It's where this balance is. So, you know, we look after organic farms, we look after very intensive farms. Our job, really, is to try and help people's business move to a better place. The difficulty being, though, is that if you want to grow crops purely chemically, eventually you're going to have to provide all the inputs of health, nutrition, fungicides, herbicides, because the soil isn't able to provide that. We're working outside of nature.
You're not organic, though, here, are you, Tim?
No, I'm not. We like to call it beyond organic because we're getting the best from the soil. We're getting fungi back in when we're not using any tillage. Our holy grail is to be organic and do no-till. And whether we'll ever get there, I don't know.
Tim mentioned no-till there. I will explain what that is later in the programme. That's a promise and not a threat. Now, soil has become, well, for want of a better word, trendy just at the moment. Everyone's talking about it. Post-Brexit, under the new Agriculture Bill going through Parliament at the minute, farmers like Tim, who look after the soil, could be eligible for financial payments under the public money for public goods approach. How, though, can you measure what benefits your soil is bringing and how good it is? Anna Hill joined Stephen Briggs on his organic farm on the Cambridgeshire Fens. He's a farmer with a master's in soil science. He showed Anna a special bit of kit he uses to test his soil.
This is a tool we use for measuring compaction. It's called a penetrometer. It's a long piece of stainless steel, but what I'm looking to do is press it into the soil with my hand and push down, trying to find areas of tight soil, because if I can't push this piece of steel bar into the soil, I can't expect the roots of my crops to go exploring for water and nutrients.
How far is that going down? Let's have a look.
So
here we go.
We should be able to push this in as deep as possible.
What? Has it gone all the way down?
Right the way down to its base.
About 2.5 feet?
Which is about just nearly a metre long.
Yeah.
When I first moved onto this farm, the soils were very tired, very compacted, and it's taken me 10 years to change our cultivation strategies and our cropping systems to actually rebuild some of the soil health.
If we're looking at soil as a public good, how do we measure that?
It's really difficult. A mug full of soil that we send to the laboratory represents 25 acres of land, so at best it's a representation in time and space.
But if a future agriculture subsidy system relies on measuring this sort of thing as a public good, how can that be done?
The public goods that flow from improving soil health include water quality, biodiversity above and below ground, the field fares and the starlings that we saw driving into the field, air, water and landscape, all those things that are considered to be public goods. But science already knows that there are these practices which improve soil and those that degrade soil. So in terms of monitoring things and measuring things as a public good, I think we're better placed to look at how we can encourage and incentivise farmers to manage their soils in the right way and undertake practices that we know improve soil rather than degrade soil.
I'm going to put you on the spot. How much do you think you should get paid in a subsidy system post-Brexit for the public good that you're providing in your soil?
That's a thorny question, isn't it? The work that I've seen done looking at rewarding farmers for building carbon would suggest that anywhere between £40 to £60 a hectare would be a reasonable sum. There's an opportunity for our government to build a domestic carbon trading framework for agriculture. We could then use not public money, but use industry money to offset some of their negative activities in a carbon tax.
Are you suggesting that maybe an airline company could offset their carbon use by paying you to sink some carbon into your soil?
Why not? We know that certain practices use carbon within their operations, so why not offset some of that by building carbon elsewhere?
Stephen Briggs in Cambridgeshire there. Well, I'm in the West Midlands this morning and I promised you we were going to talk about no-till, so let's do that now. I'm with Tim Parton, who farms here just outside Wolverhampton. Explain no-till.
Basically, with no-till, we're not trying to disturb any soil. We want the biology to be alive. If you can imagine somebody putting a ball and chain through your house, and then just as you're starting to rebuild it, somebody puts a ball and chain through again, you're never ever going to reproduce yourself or grow.
So you're comparing ploughing a field with putting a ball and chain through a house, really?
Really, because fungi is so sensitive, and you're just taking a plough through there, you've just destroyed everything, you're destroying the whole environment.
So practically then, if you're not ploughing, what are you doing?
I'm using nature to cultivate my soil, so I've got worms everywhere now. Everywhere you go on the farm, the worm casts, and I'm using plants. I grow tillage radish that will get down deep. Any compaction that's there, it will just smash through. The worms let air and water get into the soil, so I'm not having any water lying on the soil. The less you disturb soil, the less compaction you get. So the whole soil, when you walk on my soil now, it's like a spring, like a sponge. You can feel it under your feet. So when tractors go across, it just springs back up.
Okay, that's the sales job. Mike Harrington, who's the agronomist here, is also with us. Mike, there are suggestions that although the no-till has become this big buzzword, that actually it can lead to some problems like compaction.
It can. That's generally the beginning point, though. When we start direct drilling, the soils aren't in a biological state to be able to function. So for the first year or two, sometimes they go backwards. And so in the first year or two, we have to look quite carefully at where these limitations are so we can manage and help the soil move forwards. And within 2 or 3 years, if we're careful, the soils will start to actually function in their own way.
Tim, we're just walking into a field here. It's actually, the wind is getting up here this morning. If you were thinking of going out without a jumper, frankly, think again. Tim, what are you growing in here?
This is a 10-species mixed cover crop.
What is the main crop going to be in here?
The following crop will be lupins.
And what's the idea of the cover crop? What's it there to do?
The cover crop's there, it'll take out compaction. So I've got radish in there that's deep rooters. I've got shallow rooters at the top, so it'll be releasing phosphorus. It'll be releasing potash. There'll be nitrogen going back in. The whole system starts to work, so it's feeding the following crop.
So this crop is actually not to be cropped and sold. It's actually there to improve your soil, getting it ready for your lupins.
It is. It's feeding my main employers on the farm, which are my worms and the biology. I'm always trying to work before things happen, so I'm aware glyphosate is in the balance at the moment. So what I've done here, I got up at 4 a.m. in the morning. I roll on a frost when it's about -4, -5. Rolling at -5, it breaks all the crop up into tiny little pieces. It just shatters, which makes perfect food for the biology. And then with doing that, I haven't got to put as much glyphosate on.
And I suppose the big advantage here, Tim, is that the soil is never bare. It's always covered up with something.
I never ever want to see bare soil. I always want it protected with an armoury. And then I'm not going to lose my soil, so I don't get erosion. When you look at my drains running off the fields now, they're all running gin clear.
Okay, let's go and have a look at a drain. Come on. The proof of the pudding here. And here we are at the drain or the ditch or numerous other names, depending on where you are in the country. And he's not wrong. I've got to be honest, it's running fast and it's clear. He's got a smug grin now, haven't you, Tim?
I am. I'm a content man. You only have to look at all our estuaries around the country. They're all full of soil. We can't get that soil back. It's so precious. To let it just drain away, it's just madness.
Well, soils do all sorts of things. It stores 10 billion tonnes of carbon in the form of organic matter, and over half of that is actually stored in peat. Now, in peat, carbon is locked into vegetation, which is submerged in waterlogged ground, and its decomposition is slowed by the antimicrobial action of sphagnum mosses. Now, if the peat is drained or degraded, that stored carbon is released. The Committee on Climate Change says more carbon is released from damaged peatlands in the UK than from our oil refinery industry. Well, Sarah Falkingham braved the wind and rain to visit one of the most damaged moors on the Yorkshire Dales, where she met Jenny Sharman from the Yorkshire Peat Partnership, who's heading up new restoration work.
Just looking out now, all you can see is just mist, but a moment ago it revealed itself in all its glory, this horrible degraded peatland that we've nicknamed the Somme. I can see, Jenny, that the peat is exposed, it's all scarred and there's fissures. What's caused this damage?
We don't know specifically on the site what would have kicked all of this off, but most typically it would have been a large fire, it could have been overgrazing, or it could have been drainage systems, so the grips that were put in the sort of 60s, 70s. But as soon as either of those go, either the vegetation or the water goes, then the oxygen is able to come in and it all becomes decomposed, and suddenly we've got a wonderful carbon sink becoming a carbon source.
So all these areas of brown land I can see exposed, where the vegetation's just vanished because it's dried out, the carbon's just going up into the atmosphere here?
Absolutely, yep. The amount of water that you can see that's coming off. All of this is going to be going down straight into Bardale Beck, which then leads into Semmer Water. This is carbon being released. Right now we're seeing erosion happening because of the water flow and the amount of water that's coming off here.
So because it's so scarred and there are so many little gullies pockmarking Fleet Moss, it's all just leaching out. Everything's leaching out, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do we put the problem right?
The main two things that we're trying to do is to keep the water up here. So we use dams, either stone dams, timber dams or peat dams, slow the flow of the water and help that sediment build up so that it can build up all the gullies and prevent the erosion. But the second thing we try and do is revegetate as well. It's quite an operation where helicopters will bring in loads and loads of brash, which is chopped heather, which will contain dwarf shrub seeds like all the crowberries and other plants, and then we'll also put in plug plants, so cotton grasses and sphagnum as well. So that's all part of the process.
Okay. This here is a tiny, tiny little bit of sphagnum. So this is our key building block for peat. It's incredibly important. But as you've seen, it's taken me a while to find any sphagnum on this site, which means that if we didn't bring back sphagnum, the peat wouldn't actually be able to build up again by itself. So it's key to actually helping us then to continue to store carbon.
The peatlands in the UK hold more carbon than all of our forests put together. Globally, the peatlands cover 3% of the earth, but they hold 30% of the world's carbon. So two times as much as what the world's forests hold. If we want to take climate change seriously, which of course we should, then this should be a priority, really. It's a low-hanging fruit. They are our rainforests.
Jenny Sharman there from the Yorkshire Peat Partnership with Sarah Falkingham in a torrential storm. You're listening to Farming Today This Week here on BBC Radio 4 with me, Charlotte Smith, and I'm dry this morning. I'm on a farm near Wolverhampton with farmer Tim Parton. We're talking all about soil, but as you can probably tell, we've come inside into one of the farm buildings and we're going to talk about brewing. Tim, why? What are you brewing that has anything to do with soil?
I'm brewing up Bacillus subtilis, which is an actual bacteria which will fix nitrogen from the atmosphere, and it will also release phosphorus from the soil for that plant to take in. The air is 78% nitrogen. Why on earth would we not want to get some of that? It's free.
Well, spoken like a true farmer there. So just out on the corner of the yard here, you've got a big plastic tub with, scientifically I'm going to describe it, brown liquid in it.
Yeah, so basically what we've got here, we've got an air pump which is working away, which is putting aerating the liquid, and then we've got molasses in there, which is a food source for the bacteria.
Oh, I'm just peering in, and as the air pump gets going, it sort of looks like thin boiling gravy. So in simple terms, this is a natural alternative to fungicide and fertiliser?
Yes, basically. Yeah.
So has this meant that you've actually reduced the number of things you have to buy to put on the land here?
Very much so, yes. Last year we grew some spring barley and I did a trial on there where we reduced the nitrogen by over 50%. We didn't use any fungicides, and according to the Combine Yield Monitor, we had exactly the same yield across the field.
Mike Harrington, Tim's agronomist, is with us. Can anybody use this then?
Yes, they can, but when we have a soil in a good condition, which has got, it's aerobic, it's got good root systems. All these bacteria are aerobic, so they need air to function, and they also need a food source and root exudates.
So this is sort of stage two then, when you're trying to improve your soils, because if you do it too early, there won't be enough air for it to work.
They don't work, no.
So Tim, how long have you been doing this now?
This will be coming up to my 10th year.
And have you noticed a difference? What are the sort of three things you'd say have changed on the farm since you changed your approach?
Gosh, three things. Worm numbers have just quadrupled out of proportion. When you walk on the soil now, it's springy, you can feel the life in it. We've got all the wildlife here back. Farming's a joy now. Everything is just fitting into place.
Well, Tim mentioned worms there, and to be fair, as we've trudged around this farm today, he's really been noticing an awful lot of worms. They are vital for soil health, and a nationwide survey is currently studying populations of worms on farmland after last year's pilot study showed that 4 out of 10 fields had a worrying lack of one crucial type of worm, the deep burrower. Well, Jackie Stroud from Rothamsted Research is behind this project. She wants farmers to carry out a simple count and then send her the results. Our reporter Alan Beach joined her on Overbury Farm near Tewkesbury for a worm hunt.
I'm on the side of a hill and I'm looking out. I can see the town of Cheltenham in the distance. We're quite high up, and the farm actually rises from 100 to about 1,000 feet. So there's a big difference in the soil that we get on this farm. With me is soil and worm expert Jackie Stroud and farm manager Jake Freestone. So Jackie, just explain, a worm's a worm, isn't it?
Oh, there's so much more to worms than that. We have about 29 different species of worms in this country. But in our fields, what we like to try and check for is that we've got the three different types of worms. We have the surface worms that help break down the organic matter on the surface. We've got the topsoil worms, which help fertilise the soil. And we've got the deep burrowers, which are important for water drainage and air movement into the soil.
OK, so we've come into this field. Jake, what happens now?
We're looking for middens, and the midden is sort of the reservoir, if you like, or the fridge for the deep burrowing earthworm. And they come out of the ground, usually at night when it's damp, and they'll scurry around as far as they can sort of stretch and reach, bringing that crop residue, so the straw and the leaves of the old crop or farmyard manure, if we've been applying that, back. And it creates like a little sort of dome over the top of their burrow.
You're just using what an ordinary fork to take out a sort of large divot of soil.
We've got 12 worms in this one small soil pit, which is fantastic. Then the next step is to look for adult worms. Do you know what an adult worm looks like?
No.
here we go. An adult worm is the worms that have a thickened ring on them, the reproductive ring. So these are all juveniles. You see, they're just very smooth all over their body.
What's the situation as regards worm population health?
It's really hard to say. They've been overlooked. But what we do know is that cultivating frequently, you do change the community structure because you lose their food sources that are on the soil surface. But by doing activities like this, if we can do this year in, year out, then we'll get a really good feeling as to where things are going and how we can improve them.
Now, that last field only had about 6 inches of soil in it. So we've come to this one to look for some deep burrowing worms. Right, Jake, so we've moved to a different field now, and this one's full of sheep. So it's got an electric fence around it, so we've got to be fairly careful about how we get
in. Yes, tiptoes, I think.
Yeah, I've got little short legs.
Just one look at this soil, and you can see really nice burrows. You can see these sort of pen-size burrows through the soil, and that's how water and air can really move through the soil.
It's difficult to believe that just a burrowing worm can help drain the soil.
The deep burrowing earthworms, a really good population would be about one every spadeful. So if you can imagine, your soil becomes like a giant colander. Ah, fantastic work, Jake. We just found a really nice deep burrowing earthworm here.
And Jake, did you know about worms before getting involved in this?
No, not at all. And I think that's what's been really part of the fun of it, actually. Yes, here we are. We're at work. Glorious day. Counting worms that are actually contributing to or showing a sign of how we're farming and showing improvement, which is great, but we're actually also learning about them as well. Amazing things, learning all the time.
Farmer Jake Freestone there. We've walked into a little woodland here on the farm and come almost to a little encampment, really. There are two trees and then strung in between them an array of bird feeders. I can see seeds and peanuts and all sorts of things. I'm surrounded by people, unusually on a farm, just taking down some mist nets. Good morning.
Hello.
Who are you and what on earth are you doing?
My name's Colin McShane. We're a group of bird ringers locally called Belvide Ringers, and we've been working with Tim for quite some time now, monitoring the birds that are on the farm.
And one of your colleagues has just got a little bird here.
Yes.
Hello, Paul. Just explain, talk me through what you've got here.
It's a goldfinch. We've just been catching quite a few this morning. The habitat here is quite good for this particular species.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Tiny.
So we put them in these little bags just to keep them quiet and safe. And then in a few minutes, we'll take them back to the car and put a unique numbered ring on its leg.
Why ring something like a goldfinch?
Okay, well, several reasons, really. Ringing was initially introduced to try and track the movements of birds, but one of the more useful things we can do is track the population. So by estimate the number of birds that are here, the number that are ringed and the number that are not ringed, we can then sort of get some idea of how many birds are around, the population size, how many adults, how many juveniles, how many males, how many females, and so on and so forth.
It's amazing, just as you're standing here with this little goldfinch, just in the palm of your hand, because they're ever so small, and I've seen loads of goldfinch. I've never been up this close, and they're such amazing colours. So you've got the red bit around the beak, and then the flashes of really very bright yellow when you
superb,
get up close
aren't
to
they?
It. So relaxed in your hand there, isn't he?
I had a word with it earlier.
So have you noticed a change over the years that you've been here and the years that Tim has changed his approach here?
We've not been here that long to notice that much of a change. What we can say is that we are looking at this in comparison to some other farms around here. There are quite a few species here which seem to be doing incredibly well. So things like skylark, for example, and some of the nocturnal feeding birds, woodcock, snipe, jacksnipe. There are a lot of them on this farm.
Tim, you're being all bashful and shy, but you must be so proud.
Very proud.
Is this what you wanted when you started thinking about soil and changing what you were doing? Did you realise it would change quite a few things here on the farm?
I expected it to change, because it's changed the whole ecosystem, so everything's got food, and that's why everything's come back.
When I first started talking about soil on this programme, somewhat reluctantly, I will admit, because I thought it was going to be really boring, wrongly, people were a bit sceptical, but over the years, there has been a change, hasn't there, in attitudes? I would imagine when you go to the pub or talk to your neighbours, people are different in their attitudes, are they?
There's been a total change. When I first started out, everybody just thought I was mad and they couldn't understand why I was doing it or anything. All of a sudden now I'm Mr. Popular, everybody wants to talk to me. So it's lovely to see. Soil is it's so precious and we've got to look after it.
I could talk about soil all day, but sadly I'm not allowed. That's it from us here in the West Midlands. I'm Charlotte Smith and the producer is Heather Simons.